Hi, this is Jim Swilly. Welcome to Metron Live. Metron is a Greek word that means sphere of influence. I believe in living your best life possible, and that's the reason for this podcast. This is my Metron. Now let me help you discover yours. Welcome to Metron Live podcast, coming to you from beautiful, historic Midtown Atlanta. Metron people, would you give the podcast people a big hand? Welcome them. Again, thank you, Charles McFall, the rock god of podcasting. We speak into this atmosphere and we say, let there be light. I want to start today by referring to the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. I think most of you probably know who he was. He was the father of the Franciscan order, which the current pope was is a part of that. That's why he's named Pope Francis. He's named after him. Pope Francis was, you know, he was a pacifist. He was an animal lover. There was a lot about him. And most people are familiar with his prayer. Michelle, go to the other meme. Yeah, that one. This is the traditional prayer of St. Francis that is ascribed to him. It's, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there's hatred, let me sow love. Where there's injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love, for it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen. It's a great prayer. It covers pretty much all of the aspects of life. It's one of those classic prayers that's up there with the Serenity Prayer and a lot of them that are, I'm all for them. You know, I mean, I think there's a certain communal connection that people have with certain prayers. I see the validity in it. Some of you that came out of liturgical churches, you did the you said the Apostles' Creed when you came in. There's value in all of that, as long as it doesn't become a ritual that has no life to it. But like, I know the last thing when I went to see Patrick a few days before he crossed over, he had said some words to me, and the last thing I said over him was the 23rd Psalm. And it just, you know, it brought peace to him. As I was saying those words, he laid back and closed his eyes, and I thought, well, he's not going to be here much longer. But there's a familiarity of those words. Same thing with the Lord's Prayer. The one that we open up with here on Sundays, it's got sort of a metaphysical aspect to it, but it's those words that are, you know, they're just recognizable. They resonate with people, and so there's value in all of those things. I came across this a few weeks ago, however, and first of all, before I show you this, it's called the Quantum Prayer of St. Francis. Before I share it with you, I want to go to John chapter 14, verse 6. And, you know, as I've told you this before, when the Bible was written, it wasn't written in chapters and verses. So when Jesus said, I go and prepare a place for you, where I am, there you may be also. I've used this at funerals for years, but really he wasn't talking about mansions in heaven. As a matter of fact, the word mansions isn't even, Jesus never said the word mansion. It was a way that a British man in the 17th century interpreted the Greek word mone, which means place of ministry. And Jesus was specifically saying it to Peter. If you read John chapter 13, it's where Jesus talks about one of you is going to deny me, one of you is going to betray me. And Peter says, well, they can all betray you, but I never will. And Jesus said, well, before the rooster crows in the morning, you're going to deny me three times. But then he goes right into what we have is John 14:1, but it was a continuation of thought in the original text. He says, but let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mones. It's M-O-N-E. It's a Greek word, which means place of ministry. Which what he said, it's the ultimate unconditional love, because he says, Peter, I know you think you mean that, but in a few hours, you're gonna freak out, and you're not gonna be able to handle, because Jesus had asked them before. He said, "Can you drink this cup?" And he's basically saying, "You think you're gonna be able to, but you're not, because it sounds really good in theory, but when soldiers come to arrest me, it's a terrifying thing. And you think you want to die with me, but when it comes right down to it, you may not want to." Sometimes I listen to top 40 music, and there's so much about "I would die for you." I would die. I think, I don't know. Would you? I think you'd have to really have a strong connection with somebody to, or what? Or be Prince, yeah. But Prince wasn't the only one who wrote it. But a lot of people will say, I would do this for you, whatever. And sometimes when there's a real test, people don't pass the test. I mean, really, this is a little bit of a stretch for me to connect these dots here. But in a way, I kind of look at those of you who have been with me for years and have stayed with me. I kind of see you as the champions that hung in there no matter what. Because I had a lot of people who, days before I came out publicly were saying, you're the most anointed man of God. You're my bishop. You have the words of life. And then I told them one thing about me. They're like, "To whom it may concern, do not ever speak to me again." And like, wow, on Tuesday, I was the most anointed man you've ever met. That's amazing. I was gay when I wrote "It's the Anointing." When I wrote "A Year in the Now," all that stuff that you said changed your life, it all came from me. I haven't changed. Your perception of me changed. And those of you who stayed with me were some, I'm sure most of you were like, "Wow, didn't see that coming." But you do have the words of life. Where else would we go? And you had to deal with your own families. And, unless you're a friend of Sonia just took care of anybody that said, "You still have bishops?" Well, let's just say they don't ask anymore. So you don't ask women who came out of the military that, because they will shut that down very quickly. But the thing is that I'm sure there were people who told me how anointed I was who meant it, but they had their own prejudices that they just could not get past. And I'm okay with it. I'm honestly, if anything, have compassion for it, because I know many of those people have people like me in their families that they can't accept. And it's sad for them. So I don't look down on it at all. But I also look at those of you who stayed with me and said, "Well, thank you. Thank you that when you said I was your pastor, you really meant it." Because I probably did put you to the test. It probably did challenge you. And the fact that you overcame the challenge, I never ever take it for granted. So when Peter said to Jesus, "I'll never betray you," he meant it. And Jesus was basically saying, "Peter, you're much more human than you realize. But let not your heart be troubled. It's not going to disqualify you. You will still have a place in the ministry." And we see that in chapter 20, because Jesus, remember when he meets Peter Jesus is on the beach after the resurrection, and the disciples see him. And Peter's, his reaction is just, he forgets that this thing happened. You ever been mad at somebody and then you forgot you were mad at them? And you text him, "Oh, I forgot we're not speaking." Peter just jumps out of the boat and swims ashore. He says, "It's the Lord." Because that's what he really felt. When Jesus told the rich young ruler, he said, "Well, if you really want to follow me, sell everything you have, give it to the poor." And it says the man went away with great sorrow because he had too much wealth. In other words, he really loved Jesus. And it's the only time in the Gospels that it specifically says Jesus loves somebody. I know Jesus loved people, but I'm saying it specifically says when Jesus met the rich young ruler, he loved him. In other words, they had some kind of connection. But all Jesus was saying was just testing him. He didn't make it a rule for everybody to sell everything they have and give it to the poor. But he said it to this man, and this man said, "That's a deal breaker. I can't do that." Let me tell you something. If you have a relationship that goes through something that should have severed the relationship and you survive it, the relationship will be stronger than it was before the thing happened. And not everybody can do it. Not everybody can. I mean, I've counseled with married people for years and years and years, and I've seen some people who have weathered the storm of infidelity and a lot of things. And they got through it, and their marriage was stronger later on. I've seen other people that they just couldn't do it. And I had compassion for them as well. Because of their life experiences, they just did not have it in them. And you have to know what you're capable of. That's why Paul says, if it be possible, as much as lies in you, live peaceably with all men. Meaning, it's not possible with everybody. I mean, you do the best you can. But this whole idea that I'm a Christian, I love everybody, that's just not true. You don't. You have to work on it with some people. You say you love them, but not really. The point is, I mean, I'm just being real. So Jesus says, let not your heart be troubled. Peter, you do believe in God and you do believe in me. And in my house, you have a room that has your name on the door and nobody's ever going to take that room from you. It will not. He could have said it this way. He could have said, if you deny me 1,000 times, your room in the house is secure. You will not be kicked out of the house. I will not change the locks. You still have access. I mean, really, when Jesus said, in my Father's house are many rooms, that's one of the most inclusive statements Jesus ever made. Because he's basically saying, the Father's house is a really big house. And there are a lot of people who live in that house. And so he says, he goes on to talk to them, and he says, and where I go, you know, and the way you know. And they say unto him, Lord, we do not know where you go, and how can we know the way? And in verse 6, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. Now, unfortunately, people with limited understanding of original languages have turned something beautiful that Jesus said completely around and made it mean the exact opposite of what he was talking about. Because traditional Christians have interpreted that to say, if you are not a Christian, you will go to hell. That was a stretch, but that's what they heard. No man comes to the Father but by me. Jesus did not say, no man comes to the Father but by Christianity. That's not what he said. The worst thing that ever happened to Jesus was Christianity. The development of, I was watching a thing on, I think it was Netflix this week, about the history of the Bible. And it's, if you're not comfortable having really deep concepts challenged, do not watch it. Because it's biblical scholars, but they show you where the Bible came from. And many of them even deny that Jesus historically even existed, that it was a composite of Dionysus and a lot. I mean, there were other deities that had virgin births, had 12 disciples, even had a Last Supper kind of thing. So if that kind of stuff messes with your head, don't watch it. I watched it because I can look at it critically and say, interesting point. Historically, I still believe that there's something real about the Jesus story. I don't believe that there's a Santa Claus who lives at the North Pole, but I do believe there was a Saint Nicholas who did live, and much of the Santa Claus myth is based on the reality of that man. So yes, I do believe Jesus was real. You're like, really, Bishop? Duh. Isn't that why you have a job? Well, let me tell you this. A lot of people preach things that they don't really believe. They preach basically where the money is. I can't tell you how many megachurch pastors over the years told me in private. It was usually after they'd had a glass of wine after dinner, after their service. They'd say, I just want you to know, I believe everything you preach, but I never say it publicly. Why? Because you take the devil away from people and you're going to lose your finances. And you got to keep them scared and you got to threaten them. If I said his name, you would all know him, who said to me, no, if you're going to keep the money coming in, people have, you got to keep their feet to the fire. You got to threaten them that something's going to happen to them if they don't pay their tithes. I said, that's possibly the scariest thing I've ever heard. I wanted to go to his church and say, "Excuse me, run for your lives." No. No, it wasn't him, but hush. Don't say any names. It's been many of them that have said. And so even, you know, I mean, I had a big church. I had to have money to operate. So you have to sort of reinvent the wheel. Like, wow, can you take away the threat? Like, could you tell people they're not in danger of going to hell and maybe they would still love Jesus? Is that possible? And I have found out it is true. There was apparently something that happened to you in your spiritual journey, whether you call that being born again or baptized in the Holy Spirit or whatever, it was authentic enough with you that you have been open to challenging it, challenging the validity of it, and still know that something real happened to you where you believe in something that we call God. And if you ascribe a personality to that, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine. So when Jesus says, "I am the way," he wasn't saying it's my way or the highway. It's, look, if you're gonna get an essence of what Jesus was about, you cannot just pick out one little soundbite out of a verse and build a doctrine out of it. You kind of have to look at everything that was recorded that the person said. Like, for instance, have you ever heard somebody tell you that somebody said something and you know that person and you think that just doesn't sound like something they would say? Like, if you heard somebody, like, it was interesting. I was talking to Mom night before last, and she said, "Jared, for dinner, he just made tomato sandwiches. You must have bought some tomatoes." And she said, "Just like your daddy, he loved him." I'm thinking, well, that skipped a generation, because I do not. I'm glad that that gives you some affinity, but not me. Like, if you heard, if you saw, I tweeted, "Man, I just made the best tomato sandwiches," then you would know he couldn't have said that, because you know that the devil is. Now, if you cook them, I like anything, you know. Ketchup, marinara sauce, tomato juice. If I'm not driving a Bloody Mary, I'm fine with any of that. I even like sun-dried tomatoes, and I like fried green tomatoes. Just not. But if you know me, you would know. Or if I posted some, if you ever saw a tweet that said, "Man, you couldn't pay me to go to New York City," then you would say, "Bishop, you've been hacked." Or there's something wrong, because that just doesn't sound like something you would say. I remember one time, I don't even remember he knew this, but somebody came to church, and this is back when Jimmy Mayo was working for me, and he told me something that Jimmy had said to him and threatened him with. I said, "I'm not calling you a liar, but I've known Jimmy for 40 years. I just cannot believe he said, no, he said," I said, "you know what? I'm going to take his word over yours, because I don't know you, and I've known him for a long time, and that just does not sound like something he would say. So whatever your issue is, you must have gotten it wrong, but that just didn't happen." I remember what years ago, we used to, when the church was really young, we used to go to Shoney's a lot after church. All the other church groups would be in there, and this woman called me one day. And she said, "I just need to tell you that my kids were in Shoney's and they heard you cuss out the hostess because she wouldn't give you all a table." I said, "What? What did he say?" I said, she, the string of profanities. I said, "I don't know who you're talking about, but I'm standing. First of all, I wouldn't do that anyway. Secondly, I'm standing there with a group from my church. You think I'm going to cuss out the hostess at where we eat every week, where I walk in and they're like, 'Hey, Reverend Swill,' and I'm going to use that language that you just, I mean, he must have me confused." I said, "Oh, no, it was him. He wouldn't lie." And I said, "Can I talk to your son? Because I can't." So I was at Chick-fil-A a few days later across the street, and I read the name tag, And I said, excuse me, are you the kid that said, told your mother that I cussed out somebody? He said, and I could tell the way the color drained out of his face. He was busted. I said, you know good and well that did not happen. And he said, I'll take care of it. And I'm like, why would you do that? But my point is like, if you had heard somebody say that I did that, you would have to say that they must be mistaken. There's no way. I mean, I was a waiter. I mean, if there's any group of people I'm compassionate with, it's people in the food service business, because it's hard work. I'm a good tipper. I'm a good customer. That just couldn't happen. So when you hear that, when you hear somebody quote Jesus in a way that makes you feel disconnected or excluded, you have to kind of go back and look at, that doesn't sound like the other stuff that he said. For instance, this, some of the stuff we were talking about on the way back from the airport the other night, when there's a guy who's out there doing miracles and he wasn't part of the original group, and the disciples came to Jesus and they said, we don't know who this guy is, but he's preaching in your name, and we didn't sanction him. He's not part of us. We need you to call down fire from heaven from him. And Jesus, on him, Jesus was so laid back about it, he said, don't worry about it. He said, those that are not against us are for us. Well, that's virtually, that idea is nearly completely absent in church world now. Everybody's against everybody. Not just in church world, but I mean, you look at tribalism has become so extreme now that even among the Democrats, there's tribalism. Like, they can't even get a thing passed because even the Democrats can't agree. And you're like, wow, it's us versus them in nearly every strata you look at, but especially in church world. Or Jesus in John chapter 10, where he says, he's talking about the good shepherd, and he says, by the way, I have sheep and other pastures that you don't know anything about. And he said, but they're all going to come together, and ultimately they're going to have one shepherd. Which is, that's the message of universalism in one statement. So you say, well, then what about Jesus when he said, those who believe and are baptized are saved, those who do not believe will not be. You have to understand what he was saying. And I love a lot of translations. I use different translations because I think some of them pick up a nuance of something that resonates with me. The Mirror Bible that's been out, it's been out for a few years. It's probably been out about a decade. And it's really, really good. They have an app with it, the Mirror Translation. But this translation is the closest to the original Greek that I've ever seen. And I'll show you. It says, Jesus said, my I am-ness mirrored in you is your way. Now, that's very different than I am the way, the truth, the life. He says, my I am-ness mirrored in you is your way. This is your truth and also your life. Every single person can now come face to face with the Father entirely because of my doing. Do you understand what he's saying there? He's saying, the way that I self-actualized, the way that I realized my divinity, you're going to have to do the same thing. You follow my example. He wasn't saying, become a Christian or I'm going to send you to hell. That's not what he was saying. He says, the way that I realized and he coins the phrase, I am-ness, you have to do the same thing. It's another way of Jesus saying, take up your cross and follow me. If you believe the cross of Jesus was this singular sacrifice of sin, then why would Jesus say, everybody's got to find their cross? Everybody's got to find their Garden of Gethsemane. Everybody's got to sweat their drops of blood. Everybody's got to prophesy their own resurrection. Everybody's got to be in the heart of the earth for 72 hours and come out on the third day. That's what he's saying is, I'm the first fruits among many brethren. Now, what's this got to do with the prayer of St. Francis? Well, this is the quantum prayer. Let's go to the first thing that you put up there, Michelle, please. This is how he rephrased this, and I'm going to use this as a... Oh, is that all of it? Did you get it all in one? Okay, good. He changed it, and this goes so in line with the way we do affirmations. He says, beloved, I am an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, I am love. Where there is injury, I am pardon. Where there is doubt, I am faith. Where there is despair, I am hope. Don't you feel the anointing on those words? Where there is darkness, I am light. Where there is sadness, I am joy. Divine Master, I seek to console rather than to be consoled. I seek to understand rather than be understood. I seek to love rather than be loved. For it is in giving that we receive, in pardoning that we are pardoned, and in dying to our own limitations that we live. I am an instrument of your peace. This just washed through me when I read it. It so resonated with me. Because this is a higher level than, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Now, let me say this to you. I've quoted her many times. When I first started Metron, I remember Leona said something to me in the back. She says, we have to come to Metron because we're grown folks. She said, I can't go to some place and then teach me elementary school stuff that I already know better. She said, they live in Snailville. She said, we have to get in the car and drive here downtown because we're grown folks. And I understood what she was saying. You know, the writer of Hebrews writes in the 5th chapter, he says, brethren, by now you should be teachers, but you're still learning the elemental articles of faith. And he said, you should be eating meat by now, but you're just totally fed by the milk of the word. And you could see this all through the scriptures. Jesus saying, I have many other things to tell you, but you can't bear them now. There's this whole idea that there comes a point where you move beyond saying, make me an instrument of your peace, to where you declare, I am an instrument of your peace. This is why, and I don't mean to make a ritual out of it, but when I lead you in affirmations, that's why I will say, I am loved, I am love, I am. Because what you want to do is you always want to bring it back to the declaration of your divinity. I am peaceful, I am peace, I am. And this, you can just leave it up there, Michelle, because it so captures what I want to talk to you about today. People ask me, some of you have asked me, do we still believe in prayer? Yeah, I believe in prayer, but let me explain to you what I mean when I say I believe in prayer. You remember when we first started Metron, I did a series on the book of Job, and I went through there and I talked about how in the beginning of Job, it's an old Jewish fable. It's actually the oldest book of the Bible. And it's a terrifying concept because the forces of good and evil are just sort of playing dice with Job's life. You know, it says that Satan comes before, it's the only time Satan's really mentioned in the Old Testament. He comes before God, and God says to him, if you consider my servant Job, and he's perfect. Y'all heard that, right? I'm going. No. If lightning hit me, it would just deliver a better version of me. I fear no wrath at all. I am fearless. But Satan says to him, well, he's just perfect because his life is perfect. And he said, if you take all the stuff away from him, he'll curse you. So it's this whole, you know, there's a whole method to the entire work. It's sort of the exploration of why do bad things happen to good people. And Job seems oblivious to the concept of Satan, because in one of his friends is trying to exhort him, and he says, God didn't do this to you. Because, you know, Job was smitten, his kids were killed, his wife told him to curse God and die. And Job says, well, if God didn't do it, who did? No, he had no concept that they're of an alien force. And so finally, you know, he's the whole thing. He's very melodramatic about his relationship with God and his, you know, owning the suffering. And finally, the end of it, in chapter 40, God comes to Job out of in a whirlwind and speaks to him and says, "Job, deck yourself with majesty, and I will declare to you that your own right hand can save you." What he's basically saying is, this was neither God nor the devil. This is you. And basically, it's the humanist manifesto, because he's basically saying, Job, you don't realize this right now, but you're God and you're the devil. Now, not everybody's ready to hear that. But basically, this is what Jesus is saying, and this is what I believe is captured in this quantum prayer of St. Francis. It's taking you out of the realm of needing to ask for it and realizing that you not only already have it, you already are it. You know, when that movie came out years ago, Bruce Almighty, with Jim Carrey, the big punchline of the movie was that God says to him, "Don't pray the prayer, be the prayer." And I believe that. I think, you know, your life should become the outworking of the prayer. Now, I believe an even higher level of consciousness than that is be the answer to the prayer. You not only are the prayer, you're the answer to it. Paul said, "When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things." And he says, in the King James, says, "Now we see through a glass darkly." What it actually says in the Greek is, "Now we see in a mirror dimly." In other words, as I grow, like I noticed this with DNA, I look at pictures. When I was really young, I was nearly a clone of my mother. I mean, I look at pictures of when I was 3 or 4, we had the exact same face. Now my DNA has changed, and I can hardly see her in me at all. I see my dad. I look so much like him. I mean, every morning when I look in the mirror, I'm like, well, there, you know, there he is. Especially if I ever shaved my facial hair off. And what Paul was saying is, as your DNA progresses, you will see that it's been you all along. You thought there was something outside of you, but it was really you. When Jesus was praying to a father, he was actually praying to his own higher consciousness. He was praying to who he was before he was manifested in the natural realm. Can y'all handle this? Or you want me to? Okay. Because when he says, like in John 17, where he says, "Restore to us the fellowship that we had before the worlds began." If you believe that he was God, then how could God be saying, "I'm separated from myself"? He's basically saying, remind me of who I was before I took on the limitations of flesh. And what you call a higher power is really you manifested as something else. Like the whole concept of the 12-step program in AA is when the opening statement is, we recognize that we were powerless over our addiction. And yet, the truth is, if that system is going to work for you, you have to be proactive with it. You can say, "I recognize that I'm powerless over my addiction," but you still have to work the program. It's not just recognizing I'm powerless, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, I've got to do this every day. I've got to go to meetings. I've got to do a 12-step program. And that's true for everything. There's no, were any of you beside Ken raised in the Methodist church? We have any Methodists here? Well, what are you laughing at? I'm not dissing the Methodist. But the whole point of Methodism is that Wesley brothers worked out a methodology. There was a method to spiritual growth. And when you really look at their original teachings, it was basically this. It was like the method should be, you are completely out of victim mentality and you realize that you're the answer to your own prayers. They might not have said those words, but they were really saying, now just bear with me here, because I know we all want that Jesus take the wheel clause, but I'm going to I'm giving you all a B12 injection that's going to make you, it's going to help you get in touch with your own superpowers. And it was the whole reason why Jesus says, it is necessary that I go away. Because he's basically saying, as long as I'm here, you're going to think that you need me for this. And really, I need to get out of the way now that I've shown you my I am-ness. I've got to be removed so that you can find your I am-ness. It's the truth. You look at some of the accounts of the resurrection. You know, the angels are saying things like, why are you here? Why are you here at the tomb? He's risen. In other words, why are you obsessing over all of this? Go do the things he told you to do. If you're going to honor him, follow his example. So let's look at this. Down in this second paragraph, it says, I seek to console rather than be consoled. Now let me tell you something. This separates the men from the boys, the women from the girls. Because we all, I mean, as recently as last week, something I was going through, and I just had the thought, I wish I had a pastor. I mean, I thought, you know, because several people had called me that day with, you know, different problems and they needed me to speak to, and it's fine, and I never mind that. But I was thinking, you lucky so-and-so, y'all don't even realize how great it is to have somebody like me that you can text is going to give you the word. I wish I had that. And then I realized, well, I do have that. I am that. I already know what I would tell you. And, you know, I've told you this before, but I learned this in counseling years ago. Many times by the time somebody came to me with a problem, the problem was so complex and had so many movable parts to it. There's certainly no way we were going to resolve it in one session. And sometimes I would listen to somebody's problem. I think, man, if I was going to help you with this, you should have come 20 years ago. Because all these situations have metastasized. And like this, I mean, I don't know that any of this is fixable. But you don't want to leave people without hope. So I would say, I learned to say this. If I just didn't have anything to tell them, I would say, all right, if you'd made an appointment with Jesus today, and Jesus was sitting behind this desk, what do you think he would say to you? And every time, they would prophesy themselves. They would say, well, I think he would say, I need to let this go, I need to forget. Like the bottom line is, they already knew what they should have done. And then I would say, after they would prophesy to themselves, I would say, well, then that's what you need to go do. You already know what it is you're supposed to do. Now, when it comes to consolation, everybody wants to be consoled. I mean, that's just, if you've got somebody in your life that can speak peace to you over situations, like for instance, I don't think he'll mind me saying this, but when Jonah got married, I'd already worked out. It was on a Monday. So Ken had to get off from work. He'd had to get off the Friday before because we did a dinner at his in-law's house. So it takes some effort. I mean, he works a long ways away. So I'm like, make sure you got those days off. What time are you going to get off? And he had gotten a suit. I'd gotten a suit. There's a lot of prep that goes into a thing. Well, was it the day before the day before the wedding, because he works for a lot of clients at night. And a lot of the people out there where he works, they don't even believe COVID's real. They think the Democrats made it up or something. And so to even get people to wear masks out there is huge. So he had gone to work, do some work at a woman's house. And she texted him. She says, I just need to tell you, I've tested positive. He had his mask on, but I've tested positive for COVID. And I'm like, crap, not this weekend, really? And he said, I've gone to get tested. It'll take about an hour before I hear back. I'm like, oh, man, I do not want to go do this wedding without you there. I'm like, this cannot be happening. I mean, we've been back since March. We were early on, you know. We were knocking on J&J's door, like, y'all done with it yet? We already had our sleeves rolled up, like, hit me. And come to find out, it was fine. But at first, I started to be upset about it. I said, you know what? You're fine. It's going to be negative. It's fine. And as soon as I said that to him, he relaxed. But there was just this little moment of, man, we've gone to all this little effort for this one night, and this one woman infects you, and like, whoa. I remember what I taught, I think it was the last time we were here. I talked about how if you've ever had a energy exchange with anybody, it's permanent, and so you have to always convert that energy into something positive. I told you the story about how the woman that ran into me and gave me a whiplash, and every night when I would lay down, I would think, oh, that woman. And I realized I had to forgive her because my resentment to her looking at her phone and slamming into me was keeping me from getting a manifestation of the healing from my neck. When I forgave her, I'm not saying the pain went away immediately, but it was gone in about 48 hours. So I know there's anybody you've ever been connected with, you're still connected with them. So you need to don't let there be negative energy. Even if you never speak to them even if they're dead and gone. You have to, anytime you think about them, you have to convert that energy back into the positive. Because this whole idea of, I'm going to forgive them and la, 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 I'll never think about it, you're setting yourself up for failure. Because you think you've forgotten about it, and then one day, one morning, you'll wake up and something will trigger you, and it all comes crashing back in. So we all need consolation at different times. But there comes a time where you say, I seek to console rather than be consoled. I'm not saying that you can't get words of consolation. I'm saying your first impulse should be, how can I help somebody else? Because let me tell you something. There's a level that you reach in this thing, and most of you are already there, that you're going to have to understand why Jesus, the majority of his parables were about sowing and reaping. Most of what he talked about when he talked to the crowd. Now, granted, it was a largely agricultural society, so that's what they understood. But he spent most of his time, especially in the Gospel of Matthew, and in Mark as well, about sowing and reaping, planting. The kingdom of God is like a seed that falls in the ground. He talks about the sower sows the word. I mean, it's pervasive in all of his teaching. And even if he doesn't actually use the metaphor of a seed, he still says things like, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. So, basically, the implication is, and I think this is why so many people are stuck in this place of immaturity, that's frustrating because they know a lot, but it's like when the scripture says they're ever learning and never come to the knowledge of the truth. You have to realize you reach a point where you no longer pray it, you sow it. Like, if you're sick, you know what you help you the most? Help somebody else get well. I don't talk about this a lot because I don't want to sound like some televangelist that's trying to manipulate people for money. But if you're running out of money, the worst thing you can do is stop giving. It seems counterintuitive. Some people say, well, we just don't have it to give. You better give now. I mean, now's the best time to give. You give your way out of poverty. When the farmer realizes that he didn't have a big enough crop one year, he doesn't say, we need to plant less next year. He says, we're going to have to clear out that other acreage, and we're going to have to plant more. And so the principle is, my first impulse has got to be, how can I make a situation better rather than waiting, how can somebody make it better for me? You know what this means? And I'm sorry I'm about to tell you this, because there's no takesies, backsies. Once I tell you that, this is going to be like was it a Twilight Zone episode where the bug crawled in somebody's ear? And they got it out, and they said, well, it's fine, but it already laid eggs in your brain. And you're like, get it out. I'm about to lay eggs in your brain. you're never going to be able to unsee this or unhear this now. So I'm going to impregnate you. You're going to have to be the bigger person in nearly every relationship that you have. I'm sorry, but it's just the truth. You're going to have to be the one who takes the high road. You're going to have to stop worrying about whether they deserve it or not, because it's never been about what they deserve. You're going to have to realize, listen to me, there are some people in your life who are never going to change. And you've spent too much energy letting yourself being frustrated over it. You just need to say, I'm going to have to adjust my thinking on this, because this is the way they are. And if they are going to change at all, it won't be because I have pressured them into the change. If anything, my demanding their change is galvanizing them and causing them to double down and refuse to change. And not everybody can hear this, because, listen, we've all been victimized. We've all been betrayed. We've all been stabbed in the back. We've all got stories. Guess what? You're gonna have to be the bigger person. You're gonna have to reach that place when you suddenly say, you know, I've told that story enough. I'm not gonna tell it one more time. And if I do, I'm gonna go tell it to a therapist that I'm gonna pay for their time so that I can have some end to talking about this. Because talking about it isn't going to make this any different. Like, sometimes I'll look at something somebody posted on Facebook, and they're dealing with something they were dealing with 30 years ago when I knew them. Like, first of all, how is that person still alive? And secondly, why are they still jerking you around like that? Like, by now, shouldn't you have learned this is just the way they are? And it's not going to change. And you have to reach a point where you just say, it doesn't have any bearing on my life at all. I have, God bless them, sweet family members who post, I can tell it's passive aggressive things against them. I can just tell. And I'm not just, I know them well enough that, you know, they're challenging my theology. Guess what? I just unfollow them. I don't even block them. I'm like, post away. I know. Believe me, I know what you disapprove of. You have made it abundantly clear. I'm just not going to read it anymore. Y'all are precious. Y'all are so sweet. Y'all just keep, I know you think you're doing the right thing, but I'm not only am I not going to change, I'm getting worse. Like, when people say, we're just praying for you to come back to where you used to be. I'm like, oh no, I love the voyage. I'm not even looking at the land anymore. I've launched out to sea. Like, and I know that's real important to you, so I'm going to unfollow you, and you just post it all day long, because you'll feel in your self-righteousness that you've stood up for sound teaching. That's adorable. Y'all are so cute. One of them posted recently, the cross is still the cross. And I thought, okay, easy. Like, I get it. I'm not mad at the cross. And it's so beautiful to get to the place where you say, I don't even need to respond to this. I know this is what they think, and it's fine. And God love them. That's who they are. And I'm going to try to see what's positive about them and remember the good things and just compartmentalize my life. Like, it's not worth me even going there again. You know, in my mind, if you've had the same argument with somebody four or five times and nothing has changed, at some point you have to realize this isn't making anything better. This is the part where I say this thing, and then this is the part where you say that thing, and it's not ever going to, neither of us is going to change the other one. So we might as well figure out, who was it saying, there ain't no good guy, there ain't no bad guy, there's only you and me, and we just disagree. Song from the 70s. I know it's on Yacht Ride. Was that Pablo Cruz? Was that Pablo Cruz? I don't know. But this idea of, before I even get into the self-pity of needing consolation, my first response is going to be, how can I make the situation better? Not who was right and who was wrong. Like, I don't even care. I mean, and this takes, listen, turning the other cheek is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. Baby. It is. No doubt about it. And there's sometimes people can't do it, and I'm like, well, I get it. I mean, like, I haven't always turned it either. But there comes a point where you don't even need vindication. It's like, I don't even care if you think I'm right or wrong at this point. It's like you're not even on my radar screen now. Like, I'm not trying to prove anything to you. I'm good, and I hope you can be good. Like, that's the ultimate freedom, to where I don't have to pray for consolation now, because I am consolation. I am the consoler. I seek to understand rather than to be understood. Another major challenge, because everybody wants to be understood. I think we talked about this on Facebook the other day, but I walked several miles the other day. I walked from my house all the way. I wanted to see where the Beltline, how it went all the way to, is that Reynolds Town over there, Eddie? Is that, so I don't know, 5, 6, 7 miles, I guess. And you have to walk through that, you know, that Krog Street tunnel where all the, I don't like to drive under there, because, you know, when the traffic's kind of heavy and it's a little claustrophobic. But walking through there is kind of fascinating, because it's decades of graffiti. And, oh yeah, that was the picture I took. And walking through it's a very different experience. Walking through it is like you can look, driving through it, it's like, I don't like it. But I was looking at it and I thought, you know, everybody wants to be heard. Everybody wants to express themselves. Everybody wants to make a mark. And it's very, to me, I'm looking at it and it makes me think of hieroglyphics on ancient caves that you find that were from 30,000 years ago. Some people want to paint something and say, I was here. I existed. And there's a, you know, sometimes graffiti is obnoxious in places where it's not welcome, but some places it's really beautiful. And you look at all the expression and the artwork, and just driving around Midtown and downtown, so many artists have painted these amazing murals on the sides of buildings that look like really great works of art. And I think there's something so cool about that, of somebody saying, I want to express myself. And so because we want to express ourselves, we want to be understood. We want to explain. Let me explain. Let me tell you something. There are some things you're never going to be able to explain to anybody. This is why if somebody from another people group has a different view of something, you don't have to try to change them or validate why you don't understand them. Like, black people don't need white people to explain the black experience. Women don't need men to explain situations that only women could understand. Straight gay people don't need straight people to express their opinion about human sexuality. Like, there's so many things that you have to look at and you say, I don't know. I don't know. I was noticing there was a pop star I was seeing interviewed this week, and they have decided that they're non-binary. And they were saying, don't use the pronoun she for me anymore, use the pronoun they. And this is different from a trans experience. Trans experience is about going from one gender to the other. Non-binary is I am genderless. And I'm looking at it and I think I don't have to have an opinion about this. I don't have to decide if this fits into my concept of gender. I don't have to understand it. I don't have to have an opinion about it. And if somebody wants to be referred to as they, all right. Like, why is that such an issue with you? Like the first time, I've said this before, the first time I saw the phrase Black Lives Matter, I totally got it. There was nothing in me that wanted to say all lives matter, because I knew exactly what was meant by it. And when I see somebody says, that's why I told you, and I don't know why, it kind of makes me emotional when I tell the story, but this was a year ago, if you'll indulge me telling it one more time. And this was right in the heat of the George Floyd thing. And I was walking down Peachtree Street. This young black kid is on a scooter, and he's approaching me. And just as he got right, he looked about 14, maybe. He got right to me, and he looked at me and said, Black Lives Matter? And I said, yeah, bud, Black Lives Matter. And he just kept going. And it was just this moment where I didn't have to lecture him. Young man, all lives matter. You know, like, even if it's not something you understand, if there are people in your life that you value, then understand it for them. And so this idea of my first impulse is, let me try to understand this. Let me tell you, there are things that people do to you that were bad. They can never be condoned. But you can try to understand them. Understanding why it happened is not condoning why it happened, but it will help you in dealing with it, because it's that constant, you know, why did they do that? Why did they? You're going to drive yourself crazy asking yourself that a million times. At some point, you have to try to get inside their head, like, I'm not condoning or even trying to, I don't even know that I'd call it empathy as much as I'm just trying to understand why did they do this as from their paradigm. And then the prayer is, I seek to love rather than to be loved. Look, everybody wants to be loved. Everybody does. Just, you know, I'm kind of quasi-joking about it, but a few days ago, we're driving along, I'm listening to the Beatles channel and Sirius Radio, singing a song from Sgt. Pepper's album, which came out in 1967, so I've been singing this song since I was 9 years old. They're singing, I'm like, will you still need me, will you still feed me when I'm sick? And I stopped and I thought, holy crap, I'm going to be 64 in 6 months. It's like, I had a whole new revelation of that song. Because when the Beatles wrote that as young men, they were singing about old people. Which now, Sir Paul is what, he's 70, he's 80 now, isn't he? So that, you know, the surviving Beatles are even past that. But I don't know, I just had this moment of coming to terms with how freaking old I am. I looked over at Ken and said, will you still need me? Will you still feed me 6 months from now when I'm 64? It's like it was a whole new, like, oh my God. I can't even sing it now. When it comes on now, I'm like, turn that off. That ain't funny anymore. And so everybody wants to be loved. But let me tell you something. When all you ever want is to be loved, you know what? You're not going to find love. Look, being married is great, being single is great. There's upside to both, downside to both. But if your whole thing is, I just need somebody to be with me, you're not going to, the universe is not going to respond to that. It's got to be, I want to meet somebody that I can love and they can love me, not somebody that I can, I'm so needy, I just want to suck the life out of them. Like, nobody wants that. I mean, nobody wants that. That's why on more than one occasion I have exhorted single people, both straight and gay, who on Facebook have, you know, they'll post something like, it's another Friday night and I'm so alone. I don't know why somebody doesn't love me. I have so much love to give. I just want to go, can I just give you some relationship advice? Nobody's ever going to call me. Like, there's no person in the world. If somebody looked at that and said, I'm here, then they're just as, codependent as you are. If anybody's attracted to that, they've got their own issues. So when the prayer is, I'm not praying that anybody loves me. I'm praying that, no, I'm not even praying. I am love. I am love. That declaration sets you free to say, I am love. It is in giving that we receive. I've already mentioned this to you, but this is not just true for financial things. If I may refer again to AA, because it's on my radar screen right now, one of the strongest parts of that system is the idea of sponsors. Because what a sponsor is somebody who says, this is my struggle too, but I want to help people who are newer in the struggle than I am, or newer in recovery than I am. Because, yes, it helps the person that's being sponsored, but it helps the sponsor as well. You have to give back. I remember this was when I first started church. I think we had just moved into the grocery store there that we rented. It's not even there now on Klondike Road. There was just this one day that was really, really bad. And Conyers, I know most of y'all live there, but Conyers was a difficult community, especially in the 80s. To start the kind of church that I had there, I was not welcomed there. And the fact that I thrived as much as I did for 30 years is a sign and a wonder. Because it was, when I first rented the first little space over there, my first day I got one of those signs that you put the letters on. And I was out there opening Sunday, and somebody walks up and says, you have violated the law. This is illegal. And I'm like, there's no good morning. It's you have violated the law. And that was kind of my experience with the government the whole time I was there. And there's this one day I just had so much stuff. I actually remember, it seems so dramatic now, but I remember sitting down in the sanctuary and I thought, I don't want to spend any more time in this community. I need to quit. And I'm sitting there working out my, how am I going to do this? I was thinking the whole thing through. Like, I guess I could go get my job back working for my dad, but I just think I want to leave the ministry altogether. This is just, like, I don't get to do any of the part I enjoy. I like helping people and loving people, but my job is dealing with disgruntled, you know, it's like something all the time with this community and with unhappy people. I just don't want to do it. And I'm sitting there coming to the conclusion, I am quitting the ministry. And while I'm doing it, I'm hearing somebody pound on the plate glass window out there. Did somebody get that? Pound, 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 pound. So finally, there's this man, frantic-looking man, and I open the door, and he lunges in and grabs me and says, please help me. And he goes in this litany of, I'm starving, I'm a drug addict, I'm this, I'm that, whatever. And as I'm peeling his hands off me, I'm about to say, you came 15 minutes too late because I just quit the ministry. Let me refer to you some other churches. And I couldn't. I'm looking at him face to face, desperate. I brought him in. We had a food pantry, but then I got him something to eat, prayed for him. This is back in the day when, you know, he got saved. He prayed the sinner's prayer. He's crying. I prayed a prayer of deliverance. I mean, I think I even laid hands on him. He spoke in tongues. I mean, it was all of it. He got everything. And I'm looking at this like, you got to be kidding me. I'm trying to, like in the Godfather, keep trying to get out, and you pull me back in. And I remember thinking, you did that, didn't you? Like this, I thought, was somebody to understand what I'm going through. I need a mentor. I need somebody. I don't need to be helping somebody right now. I need help. This is the way it works. When you need help, the universe sends somebody for you to help. It don't make no sense. Because when somebody's demanding help, you're like, dude, I'm the last person you'd be asking. I'm trying to figure it out my own damn self. You know what I mean? Like, don't ask me. And yet, that's how you, I can't tell you how many times I've had a situation and somebody will call me, and as I'm counseling with them, they're saying to them, to me, wow, you have just told me exactly what I need to hear. And I think, I'm talking to myself. Like, it's going through you, but I'm saying to you everything that I need to hear. And I know what that's like to hang up the phone. They're changed for the better, but so am I. I'm like, well, the funk is gone. That thing I was feeling is gone and it was alleviated when I did the thing. I'm the salt of the earth. I'm the light of the world. This is what I do. And you, at a certain point, you have to stop whining about it. You're saying, this is who I am. This is what I do. I help people. I make things better. And sometimes you feel taken advantage of. You know, sometimes this is not the case, but there have been some times where I thought, the only time I ever hear from about anybody is when they're in crisis. Like, I would be so surprised if somebody ever just called me to talk. Because, you know, usually every phone call, every text is, oh my God, please help. And then at a certain point, you realize, well, this is why I'm so blessed. This is why I can speak something out and it comes to pass. Because I am in that category. My life is not my own. I do lay it down for people. And in so doing, in giving, I receive. In pardoning, I'm pardoned. Do you know why I've had so much mercy in my life? Because I've given so much mercy. One reason I never even worry about money for the rest of my life is I know how much I've personally given. And if I didn't personally give, I know that I've given the green light for the ministry to give. And I just think wherever the bank of heaven is, I've invested enough that it will come back to me. That's why I've told you when you hear prophecy, you have to discern what it means. When Kim Clement prophesied I was going to get $1 billion, I've never thought somebody's going to write me a check for $1 billion. What I heard in that is, I'll always have money. Like whenever there's an account somewhere that apparently has all the money I will need for the rest of my life, and if I need it, it will be there. It just will. As recently as yesterday, something I needed, and then it buzzes on the Cash App. I'm like, oh, there's the amount I needed. I didn't ask for it. It just came in. Why? Because in giving, I receive. And at a certain point, you create such a perpetual motion of it that it's just like breathing. You know, Paul got to a place with it, to the Philippians. You know, all of the book of Philippians was a thank you letter for an offering that Epaphroditus had brought him from the church at Philippi. And he writes to him and he says, thank you that you gave. But he says, I'm rich. In the Greek, he says, I'm a rich man. I didn't need it. Which I'm sure, if you're Epaphroditus and you've been on a camel for, 6 months trying to get an offering to him, you're like, well, I wish I'd known that 6 months ago. We could have kept the money. But he says, you have more need to give than I did to receive, that fruit may abound to your account. And Paul was just being arrogant. He was saying, I've reached a place now. That's when he says, my God shall supply all my need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. And earlier in that chapter, he said, look, I've been poor and I've been rich, and one thing I've learned is I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. In other words, he says, I learned this, that nothing's the end of the world, and I get through anything. And there comes a point in your life, by the time you're elderly, you should be so strong in your faith that whatever happens, you're like, if today's my day, I'm ready to go. If not, I'll live out my day. I mean, you should. Oak trees get stronger as they get older. Rivers get wilder as they get older. As you should, there should be some stuff you learned along the way. As you're growing, you should look at some things and say, this 20 years ago, this would have freaked me out, but now I've been around the block enough times, this ain't nothing but a thing. I mean, you can look at a doctor look straight in the face when he's telling you some horrible thing, and you're like, nope. Hey, you can go even beyond that and say, I don't think that's going to happen, but even if it did, I'm going to be okay. That's huge. We believe God will deliver us from this fiery furnace, but even if he doesn't, We will not bow to Nebuchadnezzar. It just, so it's not that I've stopped believing in prayer. It's just that I don't need it. I am the prayer and I answer the prayer, which is why we were talking about the whole thing about meditation. It's not that I consciously stopped praying and started meditating. It's just that the meditation is, if I'll just get quiet and detach from ego and trying to project what I want, because look, when a football game is being played, both sides are praying that they win. So what you think is your answer to prayer is somebody else's worst nightmare. So at a certain point, you just have to learn how to get quiet and find the answer within. And let me tell you how it works. And I've seen this. This is happening more than I even have realized. When you meditate, it's not like you sit there and you go, bing, I got the answer. I got it. Like, it's not, you know, back in the prayer days, we used to talk about praying through. And there's a place for it. I'm prayed through till I got the victory. The thing about meditation is, I don't know how this is going to play out, but I've gotten quiet. I'm just going to go live my life. And when I get to the thing, I'll know how to handle it. And you'll start noticing it. When you really meditate, a thing will come up. And you think, man, if this happened a year ago, I'd have been a basket case. And now it just is what it is. And it becomes a touchstone. And it's because you have gone inside and you have found your higher self. When I say higher self, you know what it's like when, you know, that good feeling that happens when you've done the right thing and you just feel like the best possible version of yourself. That's who you really are. And when you meditate, instead of praying to some sky deity on the other side of the universe, you're going within and you're saying, I'm praying to this higher self that's in me. Call it consciousness. Call it God if you want to. If that's God to you, if that's Jesus to you, fine. Tomato, tomato. You're splitting hairs over stuff that Jesus himself didn't care about. When John has a revelation of Jesus at the end of the Bible, he's not even called Jesus anymore. It's not like there's this big sign that says, his name is Jesus, you better recognize. It's like, no, his name, he's called lots of things. And on his thigh and vesture is written the Word of God, and his name is the I Am, and he's called the Word of God, and he has a name written on him that nobody knows but he himself. So when people think, I just want to get to heaven and see Jesus, well, define your terms. Because if you think there's going to be a Palestinian 33-year-old man with long hair and a beard that looks like white Jesus that you grew up seeing pictures of in Sunday school, you might be sorely, you know, somebody might come put their arm around you and go, baby, that never existed. That was your own fever dream of your personal theology. Because Anne Lamott was right when she says, when it turns out that God hates all the same people that you hate, it's likely that you've created God in your own image. And what's the other way? Who said, I don't trust people who are so sure that God told them something because it sounds so much like something they would do. I used to hate that when, it hasn't happened in years, but I used to get a lot of this when I pastored the church. People come to me and say, God told me so. Like, they prefaced what they were about to tell me with, God told me this. And then they would tell me some cockamamie thing. And I think now you've cornered me. Or I've either got to not believe that God told you that or that you didn't hear. You know, I would rather you just tell me what's up. I mean, you didn't have to play the God card. You know, people say, God told me it's time to move on. No, I did something that you didn't like. Why don't you just own it? It might be something I need to know. But when you just say ethereal and say, God told me my season here is over. I'm like, really? You know, that feels kind of bogus to me. What did I do? Or if it's something else, you just say, you know, there aren't enough pretty girls here. I'm going to another church. Fair enough. Like, all right, fine. You know, at least just tell me what it actually is. And don't do the, you can't say anything about it because I'm going to, you know, like when you used to play tag, timeout. God said it. You're not allowed to challenge it in any way. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. It is in dying to our own limitations that we live. I'm telling you, that death-life thing is going on all the time. We die on one level, we live on the next. We're going to end with a really quick meditation. And I'm going to have you out by your Falcons game. Don't worry. You're going to get it. If you bring the lights down. Huh? You good? No, I was actually talking to Eddie. Are y'all going to the game? Okay. Y'all get there. You got plenty of time. If you've never meditated with us, you don't have to participate, but I'd love for you to. Just put both feet on the floor. Empty your lap. Sit up straight. He's going to play some music. We're just going to do this for a few minutes. Most of you do this enough that you're capable of doing it easily. We're going to start with breathing. Meditation is all about breath. We're going to breathe in through the nose and hold it, and then exhale through the mouth. So let's go in. Hold it. Exhale. Inhale. Hold it. Exhale through the mouth. In through the nose. Out through the mouth. Just become consistent in your breath. Don't worry if your thoughts are restless. They'll settle down in a minute. Just let them do whatever they're going to do. Only be aware of your breathing. Find that place of serenity. Find that secret place of the Most High. Stress, detach from ego, detach from being needy, and just be. I am. Find your inner I am-ness. I am wellness. I am wholeness. I am. I am. Thank you. everything that you need, you already are. You already have it. You already are that thing that you need. The Elohim says, let us make people in our image. You are part of God. You are the image of God. Of God is in this place. Amen. Let's all stand. You're too relaxed to stand up now, aren't you? Did you get anything out of this today? I'm sorry I made everybody grow up. Now, next time you need consolation, you're like, oh, I am consolation. We'll play this in just a moment, and then I'll let you go. But remember, if you want to be a part of the meditation weekend, just request an invitation. You can go to my the cover picture on my Facebook page. You can find it there. All right?
Contributing to Metron is quick and easy. You can give anytime using any smartphone. Text the amount you'd like to donate to 404-620-5044. You will then receive a notification that you successfully completed your donation. You may also visit missionthenow.com and click the support tab to give there as well. When you contribute to Metron, you're also donating to the charity or organization of the month. Thank you for your investment into Metron.
I love you very much. Go Falcons. If I don't see you in Chattanooga, I'll see you back here on November 7th. All right? Go in peace. The angel of the Lord camps around about you.